This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'm sure that most of you know all about evolutionary relationships in terms of the extent of conserved syntony across sequenced animal species. So Frank Nicholas isn't going to talk about that today, although he could. No, he's going to talk about another interest of his, Charles Darwin's experiences in Australia. Frank Nicholas.
I'm just going to give you a very quick Cook's tour of Darwin's experiences in Australia. Because of the time limit, there's really no time to go into a critical analysis of the comments he made. We're going to hear, we've already heard some, and we'll hear more from other speakers during the course of today. I want to start with some acknowledgements, firstly to the State Library of New South Wales and its various manifestations. Many of the images I'm going to be showing you today, most of them come from the State Library of New South Wales, and this also provides me with an opportunity to acknowledge my co-author and wife who is here in the audience today. She spent several years working in the picture section of the Mitchell Library, and it was through that association that we became aware of many of these beautiful images that I'll be showing you. National Library of Australia also has contributed some of these images. Hank Eaves has provided us with access to the Gould illustrations we use. A private owner has provided us with one really key, Conrad Martin's painting. And an anonymous donor from Melbourne more than 20 years ago made the whole exercise possible, and we are still eternally grateful to that person. We don't know who it was, but they made it all possible. So we're talking about the Beagle's second voyage under the command of Captain Robert Fitzroy. And this is a sketch of Fitzroy done by Philip Gidley King, the grandson of the third governor of New South Wales and the son of Sir Philip Parker King, the famous surveyor, who'd actually been in command of the Beagle's first expedition. A key person in the story I'm going to tell you is Conrad Martins. Martins Augustus Earle was the official artist employed on the Beagle on this Beagle voyage. He became sick when they were still on the eastern coast of South America. He returned to England and died soon afterwards, having been in Australia beforehand. That's an interesting story. We don't have a chance to go into that today. Martins just happened to be in South America at the time, so Fitzroy employed him. Martins spent some time on the Beagle when they were down in Tierra del Fuego. But he was signed off then when they'd got to the western coast of South America. He worked his way across the Pacific, arrived in Sydney a few months before the Beagle did, and of course stayed there for the rest of his life. And so that's the Martins-Darwin connection, and that's what we make use of. So in the book, what we do is we transcribed everything that Darwin had written about Australia, and basically we matched that up with these beautiful Conrad Martins contemporary illustrations, as if Martins was the cameraman that Darwin didn't have when he was here in 1836. So this is just an extract from the official map of the voyage. So they spent Christmas in the Bay of Islands in New Zealand and then came across to Sydney. And the quotations I've got here are all extracts from Darwin's diary. So January the 12th, early in the morning, a light air carried us toward the entrance of Port Jackson. And this is the very first sketch, it's a very faint sketch, that Conrad Martins did of that exact scene. So here is the ship that with Martins on it approaching Sydney Heads. You can see the South Head there, and you can see the lighthouse, the Macquarie Light. And this was sketched on April the 17th, 1835, as Martins arrived in Australia. This is a beautiful Martins painting. From that Macquarie Lighthouse looking west up Sydney Harbour with a Darwin quotation up above. At last we anchored within Sydney Cove, and this is a Conrad Martins sketch done on January the 8th, 1836, 4 days before the Beagle arrived. So you can't get any more contemporary than that. And this is now Kevin Rudd's view of Circular Quay. So this is taken from the North Shore looking to Circular Quay there on the right-hand side. Macquarie Fort there right in the centre where the Opera House is. And you can see that Martins has named all the buildings. The conservatorium was there then as the government stables. And then, of course, as artists do, these were turned into beautiful paintings. So this one, here's a painting of that same scene, also done in 1836. So this is exactly what Sydney Harbour looked like when the Beagle arrived. in Sydney. This is another contemporary Martin's view. So this is now looking east, again across Circular Quay, and looking back up toward the heads. This is a sketch by Martin's of the Beagle in Sydney Cove, but you can see it's done in 1839, and this just enables me to relate very quickly that the Beagle came back here on a third surveying voyage. It was actually based in Sydney, and by that stage the people in charge of the Beagle were the people who had been the shipmates of Darwin in the second voyage, and their main task was to complete the survey of the northern shores of Australia, and it was during that time that they came across yet another geographical feature, and they named that Port Darwin in fond memory of their former shipmate. So Darwin never went to Darwin, but that's how Darwin became named. Why did the Beagle come to Sydney? The Beagle came to Sydney because Fitzroy had been instructed, after having completed the surveys of South America, to circumnavigate the globe and to check longitude using chronometers. This was the fairly new method at that stage of determining longitude. And the Beagle had more chronometers on board than any other Royal Naval ship had ever had. And these are the records. Fitzroy kept meticulous records, and you could see none of them had exactly the same time. And the person who was responsible for winding the chronometers had the most important job in the whole voyage, because if you forgot to wind them once, then that was data lost for the rest of the voyage. Interestingly, down the bottom, you can see that they took three of the chronometers by ship's boat from Circular Quay up to Parramatta. Why did they do that? Because Governor Brisbane had built an observatory just behind what's now called Old Government House at Parramatta. The remains of the observatory are still there. The only other way that you could determine longitude was by astronomical means, and so Fitzroy was instructed, wherever possible, to compare his estimates of longitude from the chronometers with the astronomical measurements. So that's why they went up to Parramatta. There is one advantage which the town enjoys in the number of pleasant walks in Botanic Garden and Government Domain, and here's a Martin sketch done in 1835 of the domain with the conservatorium in the background there. Martin's established his first studio in Bridge Street, and this is a painting of Bridge Street. Darwin, in his diary, then I hired a man and two horses to take me to Bathurst, a village about 120 miles in the interior, set of a great pastoral district. By this means, I hope to get a general idea of the country, and he did this quite often whenever the Beagle was in port for any length of time. When he did this, he carried a notebook with him. He started a new notebook in Sydney. And one of the really exciting experiences that we had many years ago in the early 80s when we discovered the existence of this notebook was to spend some time in Downhouse. The then curator, Philip Titheridge, got his big ring of keys out and walked over to the cabinet and unlocked the cabinet and handed me the notebook. And I spent a couple of very enjoyable days sitting in the kitchen of Downhouse transcribing the notebook. 16th Saturday, left Sydney, soon entered country, excellent roads, turnpike, pothouses, too much woodland, some fine trees, all peculiar, of course. Rails instead of hedges, many carts, gigs, phaetons and horses and so on. And so it goes. And Jan actually did most of the transcriptions here and became very adept at interpreting Darwin's handwriting. So this is the first day of the trip. Got to Parramatta by lunchtime. And then over to what's now Penrith or Emu Ferry by the evening. And here's a very contemporary Conrad Martin sketch of the Penrith Road just done a few days before Darwin went along it. I slept at night at a very comfortable inn at Emu Ferry, 35 miles from Sydney. Early in the morning we crossed the Nepean in a ferry boat, and here's a Martin sketch of that ferry boat. The Emu Ferry, it was just a few planks of wood strung together, really. And we've actually worked out how much it cost. With two men and two horses on a Sunday, it cost 2 shillings and 8 pence. And if you go there today, if you went there 20 years ago, in fact, you can still see the spot on the riverbank there where the Emu Ferry went across. There's a whole lot of trees there now that have grown up in the last 20 years. Having crossed the river, he then went up Mitchell's Pass, which was brand new at the time. The ascent is not steep, the road having been cut with much care on the side of some sandstone cliffs. And here's a beautiful Conrad Martin's painting of that scene. And again, that hasn't changed. You can come down the mountain that way, and it's a beautiful place to take visitors. In the middle of the day, we baited our horses at a little inn called the Weatherboard. And this is the side of the Weatherboard inn there is in Pitt Park at modern-day Wentworth Falls. In 1936, on the centenary of Darwin's visit, a tree was planted, an evergreen oak, and that's now called the Darwin Tree. About a mile and a half from this place, there is a view exceedingly well worth visiting. Following down a little valley and its tiny rill of water, Suddenly, and without any preparation through the trees which border the pathway, an immense gulf is seen at the depth of perhaps 1,500 feet beneath one's feet. And that's a Conrad Martin's painting of that exact scene. And if you go there today, nothing has changed. The point of view is situated, as it were, at the head of the bay, for the line of cliff diverges away on each side, showing headland behind headland as on a bold sea coast. And you can see those headlines there in the painting and in the photograph as well. Now, Darwin, of course, being very much a geologist at that time, immediately asked himself, how can this have come about? His initial impression is it's been erosion, but then he says this is preposterous, there's not been enough time. And so he comes up with another undersea theory. But then later in life, as he became more and more aware of the huge expanse of evolutionary time, he returned to the erosion idea, which is now the accepted idea. The class of view was to me quite novel and certainly magnificent. Then on to Blackheath, the very comfortable bin kept by an old soldier. It reminded me of the inns in North Wales. And the really interesting thing about this is that Darwin, having mixed with the, or mixing with the Kings and the MacArthurs, had a very jaundiced view about ex-convicts. But in fact, it turns out that Gardiner was in fact an ex-convict. He was passing himself off as an old soldier. So Darwin was really impressed with this man. Here's Gardiner's Inn. It was there until the 1930s and then it was knocked down. But you can still go and have lunch and even stay in Gardiner's Inn, but it's a bit like Grandma's Axe. So none of the fabric left of Darwin, maybe apart from the cellar. Early in the morning, the next morning, I walked 3 miles to see Govett's Leap, a view of a similar but even perhaps more stupendous character. And this is a lovely photograph by a professional photographer of that view. And Darwin comments in his diary that he'd seen paintings by Conrad Martens of both these views. We've shown you the one of the Jamieson Valley, and if you see here, you can see there's a view of Sydney Harbour, and then Govett's Leap, and then Fall at the Weatherboard. We've never been able to find a Martens painting of Govett's Leap. If anybody knows of one, we'd be really interested to find out. So he walked back to the hotel, then hopped on his horse down Victoria Pass, which was also new at that time. Short time after leaving Blackheath, we descended the pass of Mount Victoria, and here's a contemporary Conrad Martin sketch of that, and of course that hasn't changed much either, still the main road up the Blue Mountains. Stayed at what was then a sheep station called Balerawang near the Cox's River. The greyhounds pursued a kangaroo, so they went kangaroo hunting, didn't see any big kangaroos but saw some little ones. A hollow tree out of which we dragged it is an animal as big as a rabbit with the figure of a kangaroo. This is a beautiful Gould illustration. We put the Gould ones in here because Gould was the one who classified the birds that's already been mentioned and then came to Australia subsequently. Earlier in the day, I saw plenty of crows like our jackdaws and another bird, something like the magpie. So they were similar, but they weren't exactly the same. In the dusk of the evening, I took a stroll along a chain of ponds, which in this dry country represents the course of a river. It's a beautiful Conrad Martin's painting of the Cox's River. And had the good fortune to see several of the famous platypus or Ornithorhynchus paradoxicus. They were diving and playing in the water, but very little of their bodies were visible, so that they only appeared like so many water rats. And again here, the kangaroo rat looks like a rabbit, the platypus looks like a water vole. And here's the Gould illustration of the platypus. Earlier in the evening, I'd been lying on a sunny bank and was reflecting on the strange character of the animals of this country as compared to the rest of the world. A disbeliever in everything beyond his own reason might exclaim, surely two distinct creators must have been at work. Their object, however, has been the same, and certainly in each case the end is complete. Whilst thus thinking, I observed the conical pitfall of a lion ant. There's the pitfall and there's the lion ant. The pitfall was not above half the size of the one described by Kirby, which was the book that was on the beagle, and so Darwin immediately assumes this is a different species. It turns out that assumption may have been incorrect, but that's not of our concern now. He's assumed it's a different species, same genus. Without doubt, this predaceous larva belongs to the same genus, but to a different species from the European one. Now, what would the disbeliever say to this? Would any two workmen ever hit on so beautiful, so simple, and yet so artificial a contrivance? I cannot think so. The one hand has worked over the whole world. And that's a deliciously ambiguous statement, realising that these words are being written for the folks back home, many of whom still expected him to take up his clerical appointment. A geologist, perhaps, would suggest that the periods of creation have been distinct and remote the one from the other, that the Creator rested in his labour. And again, that's a deliciously ambiguous statement. You can interpret that in a number of different ways. So this is the first time that Darwin's ever asked these sort of questions in writing So he's asking lots of questions and doesn't provide many answers. Then on to Bathurst, and then back, and in the interest of time, we just have to race through this. Back up Victoria Park, pass. He spent a couple of nights in the Weatherboard Inn. He actually walked back down to see the view from the Jameson Valley again. He was sick there for a couple of days. Finally, descended to Emu Ferry. A few miles further on, I met Captain King. This is Philip Parker King, who took me to his house at Dunheved. Spent a very pleasant afternoon walking about the farm and talking over the natural history of Tierra del Fuego. In fact, King gave him a reprint of a paper that had just been published about some of the observations that King had made in Tierra del Fuego in the Beagle's first voyage. Here's King, and this is a Conrad Martens painting of King's farm, a very humble farmhouse. You go there now, and it's a rather pathetic sight, although it has been scheduled as a heritage site. The next day, accompanied by Captain King, rode to Parramatta, close to the town, his brother-in-law, Mr. MacArthur, it's Hannibal MacArthur. The house would be considered a very superior one, even in England, and that's a Martens painting of vineyard. That's what it looked like before it was knocked down in 1961. There was a large party, I think about 18 in the dining room. It sounded strange in my ears to hear very nice young-looking ladies exclaim, "Oh, we are Australians and know nothing about England." And if you go to the University of New South Wales now and you watch Jeff Lawson or his successors playing cricket, then you'll actually see those same pillars. They've been re-erected next to the oval in the University of South Wales. In the afternoon, I left this most English-like house and rode by myself into Sydney. Just very quickly, just to give you an idea of the specimens that were collected, this is one of the ones that were subsequently illustrated. Overall in Sydney, Darwin and Covington, between them, collected many, many insects and a whole lot of other things as well, including a mouse that was then new. It's now extinct. So we move on to Hobart very quickly, and I just draw your attention to this wonderful book that's only just recently been published, put out by the Royal Society of Tasmania, and it gives a wonderful account, a very detailed account of Darwin's experiences in Hobart. This is a Sims Covington sketch of the Iron Pot Life, the Iron Pot Lighthouse. Between the 12th and the 15th, I had been introduced to Mr. Franklin, the Surveyor General, and during these days I was much in his society. He took me two very pleasant rides, and I passed at his house the most agreeable evening since leaving England. And this is just a map of the Hobart and surroundings showing all the places that Darwin went to, and he was very busy there. And he, of course, celebrated his 27th birthday in Franklin's house, which is Secheron, which until recently was the Maritime Museum of Australia and open to the public. It's now in private hands. You would be astonished to know what pleasant society there is here. I dined yesterday at the Attorney General, where amongst a small party of his most intimate friends, he got up an excellent concert of first-rate Italian music. The house large, beautifully furnished, dinner most elegant, with respectable, although of course all convict servants. A short time before, they gave a fancy ball at 113 people present, and that house is still there. It's Stephenville. This is Alfred Stephen, who came up to New South Wales subsequently, and that's now part of a school. An oak skink, and these are shown in the exhibition here, five lizards, a snake, and he actually captured this snake, and there's an example of one down there. This is so he actually opened it up, and he says, "This is sort of curious." And the answer is, it's not a colubrid at all, it's an elapid, a live-bearing and venomous snake. And so the question is, what would have happened to the history of biology if Darwin had been killed by a snake in Hobart in 1836? He also collected some planaria, did lots of experiments on those and a huge number of insects, and here's just one of them. Off to Western Australia, King George Sound, and here's a Sims Covington sketch, and it was a very primitive settlement at that time. But they did a lot of interesting natural history. They saw a corroboree as well and made some other interesting observations. I'll just concentrate on the natural history here. The bush rat, this is one of the ones that was actually published in the zoology. It's another one that was published in the zoology. Jack mackerel, and there was another. They collected lots of fish, and there were 10 species that were subsequently published, two of them which turned out to be new. This is one of them. Lots of shells, barnacles, and again a huge number of insects. And here's just the other three that were actually published. So what's the impact of Darwin's visit to Australia? Well, there was no eureka moment. The antlion passage is certainly important. It's the first time that he actually asked questions like this in any written form. But really, I think the best way to view this is that this is just part of 28 years until the publication of Origin of Species, or 51 years if you add up the rest of his life, when he was just accumulating information from the voyage and from correspondence all around the world. Just very briefly then, after the voyage, he corresponded with a lot of people with whom he was first associated during the voyage. Covington, there's 10 letters, the Darwin letters to Covington, including one which really puts paid to any thought that that Wallace letter arrived in May rather than June. There's one letter from Martins to Darwin. There's a really interesting Clark connection there, which we don't have time to go into at the moment, but Clark was one of the few clerics who wrote to him, said, "What a wonderful book about Origin of Species, but you've left out a bit that some observations that I've made that really would make it better," and Darwin actually stuck those observations in later editions. Wickham, we put this in here because he married one of those girls, Hannibal MacArthur's, that Darwin met, and there's questions about Darwin's tortoise, which we don't have time to talk about. Philip Gidley King, he exchanged many letters with Philip Gidley King. It's already been mentioned, he did a lot of works on barnacles, 8 whole years devoted to barnacles. There were 31 species collected in Australia, and the points from which they were collected correspond to where many of his shipmates lived. And this is just one of the Australian species. And just finish off, Robin's already quoted the well-known one, but Michael Pickering in the book for the exhibition here points out that in September 1836, Darwin actually wrote in his diary, before they'd reached home, "In the same quarter of the globe, Australia is rising, or indeed may be said to have risen, into a grand centre of civilisation, which at some not very remote period will rule the Empress of the Southern Hemisphere. It is impossible for an Englishman to behold these distant colonies without a pride and satisfaction. To hoist the British flag seems to draw as a certain consequence wealth, prosperity and civilisation." And then just to finish off then, in 1854, when Hooker received the very good news that the government of Tasmania was going to provide financial backing to enable him to publish The Flora of Tasmania, Darwin writes back, "What capital news from Tasmania! It really is a very remarkable and credible fact of the colony. I'm always building veritable castles in the air about emigrating, and Tasmania has been my headquarters of late, so that I feel very proud of my adopted country." I'll leave you on that positive note.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.